Matter of DCPP versus JC and KC. May we please have appearances of counsel?
For appellant JC, it's T. Gary Mitchell, Office of Public Defender, current representative.
Molly Lindhorst from ACLU of New Jersey.
Welcome, counsel. Mr. Mitchell.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Right. Just try to keep your voice up, please.
Thank you. This appeal asks the court to revisit scope of state and judicial power under a 60-year-old statute dating from 1962. A decade or so ago, this court, largely for the first time, address that statute, NJSA 34C12, which I'll refer to as Section 12 in my argument. In that opinion, this court described its broad power and identified two key checks on that power. The checks, a six-month time limit on orders entered under Section 12, and the need for periodic judicial review of relief granted under that statute. This court pointed out the statute's constitutional underpinning was found in both its flexibility and the protective checks of a six-month time limit and periodic judicial review when the state would always have a continuing burden of proof. Indeed, this court made clear, drawing on the statute's language and structure, that there was to be no exception for these protective checks, even for an extension of a Section 12 order. Periodic review would properly cabin state power. But in this case, at the division's behest, a judge cut corners, imposing an order with no time limit and no periodic review to renew relief. That should not stand. The need for periodic review of any Section 12 order is plain here, evident in its breadth and demands, which respondents oddly minimize. I say oddly because on its face, the order provides far more than, as respondents contend, supervision by family members. It demands compliance with complicated and intense psychiatric regimens and various therapeutic interventions, including cognitive, behavioral, and medication. By its terms, such an order screams for a need for ongoing judicial supervision, time limits, periodic review, renewal only if the state's proofs continue to warrant, and access to counsel and experts to assess and evaluate the demanded interventions. On the other hand, if what is demanded of my client is as minimal as the family supervision respondents claim, then the need to employ the coercive power of a Section 12 order seems injudicious overkill. After all, a violation of such an order would permit citing my client for contempt and even risk putting family members in peril of violating a court order if supervision went awry. That is needless. Before, during, and after the divisions in the court's involvement, my client retained joint legal and physical custody of her children. And the family continues to reside together, but my client's contact with her children supervised by her husband or her parents. If family members are trusted to supervise my client, there's no reason for a judicial hammer in the form of an indefinite, effectively permanent Section 12 order to hang over their heads, as well as that of my client. Doing so connotes simply that the division wants to be done with this family, not that the order helps the family manage their affairs. Such facts suggest why all concerned must have the protections of the periodic review and time limits that Section 12 contemplates. Checks the legislature thought necessary to ensure that such matters are not left open-ended. At bottom, the order with its heavy and intrusive demands is a gratuitous, frankly, interim misuse of state and judicial power. Section 12 contemplates that such power, when exercised, must be subject to periodic review and time limits. It also bears noting what is not involved in this appeal in this court. There is no challenge to whether the restraints and other relief were warranted at the time of the last family part hearing. Rather, what is at issue now is whether those restraints can remain authorized indefinitely under Section 12, the statute on which the lower courts relied. We think the statute makes clear that without periodic review and time limits, the relief can. Respondents take a contrary position that effectively reads both the time limit and periodic review out of the law. They argue that the six-month time limit and periodic review pertains only to an initial order. And perhaps on this, they are not entirely clear, but also to an extension. Even more troubling.
Slow down a bit, Mr. Mitchell. Sure. Slow down a little bit. Raise your voice, if you don't mind.
Okay. I'm sorry, Your Honor. Even more troubling, they ask the court to read into the law an exception for orders entered when terminating Section 12 litigation. They argue that excuse me, at such time, a court's power is unconstrained. The argument, in all due respect, is absurd. To do so is contrary to the plain language of the law with its intentionally flexible but cabined authority. Under respondent's theory, a Section 12 case could be terminated upon entry of an initial order, with that order to last for all time, not limited to the 6 months and requiring periodic review. The legislature provided otherwise. In construing Section 12, this court should acknowledge that an order entered under that statute, whenever entered, is limited by the two crucial checks that the legislature put in place, orders cabined by time and periodic review. Respondents argue to the contrary, saying a parent may still challenge a Section 12 order. That, frankly, is illusory. It ignores the state's burden of proof, and that half a century ago, our courts recognized what is at stake in a Section 12 case also requires a right to appointed counsel. The need for counsel is even greater after the state grants relief, or I should say gains relief. The order here pulls the rug out from under that right. Terminating a Section 12 case ends a right to appointed counsel, meaning a parent will not have counsel to prepare a challenge to restraints or an order's demands. If a Section 12 order is ongoing, our position would be the right to counsel also must be. Your Honors, if you have further questions or some questions for me, I'd be glad to discuss them with you.
Since the termination of Title 30 proceeding, has your client received any services from the division?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I'm not certain of that, but it's been since August of 2021. We've had a long period of time during that period. We've had a long period of time elapse, and I can't say for sure, but I don't believe so.
I want to just pick up on something you ended your argument with, appointment of counsel, the argument that that would be required for this sort of action if it were to be permitted. Can the public defender provide representation? Does it have the authority to do so at this point?
If the case is closed in the court, the authorization for public defender representation, frankly, which occurs under CRIST rather than under a statute, because 34C12 still does not provide any right to counsel that's statutory. The right to counsel arises in a 34C12 case as a result of the appellate division's decision half a century ago in CRIST, which was a 34C12 case.
So is that a yes or a no?
That's if the case is closed, it would be no. To provide representation would require, as I read CRIST, an open, ongoing case under 34C12.
So you want us to reverse and remand and reinstate Title 30 with the restraints?
I think that's what would be prudent, Judge, Justice. I think the family part can then assess getting fresh proofs what might be required. But yes, I think that would be just as the appropriate action for this court to take.
With regards to addressing the mental health concerns that you mentioned in the order, exactly what are the requirements? The order indicates that your client could return to the court showing that she has complied with all the treatment. What are the requirements that she has to comply with? Is that clear?
Respectfully, I don't think that's clear. I think the failing part order kind of was a grab bag of sorts. Psychiatric regimens, psychological regimens, behavioral, cognitive, medication. The court's order left a lot underappreciated. And without the division's continued guidance and without counsel's assistance, and frankly, the experts that come along with the right to appointed counsel, I think a parent such as my client would be left guessing about what would be needed, and certainly without the tools to get back to court. It's easy to say, just file a motion, and that I dare say. When I suggested it to some of my law students the other night,
I was met with, well, what do you do? And these are second and third year law students. Somebody who's forced to proceed pro se because counsel has been removed at the conclusion, at the termination of a Section 12 case, frankly, I think would be left to guess. And I don't think that's fair to anybody involved.
If the relief that you're seeking were to be granted, would the children need to be involved at periodic reviews?
Your Honor, if the to be frankly, I don't think there would be a need. It would depend upon the proofs. Certainly, if the order is as minimal a requirement as respondents make out, there wouldn't be much to address. And it would be a minimal burden on the state at all, a minimal burden on everyone. It's only my client, frankly, that needs needs to be able to establish through counsel, through the expertise that might come along with the experts that counsel could obtain, to show compliance. And to show that kind of compliance with the or to show, frankly, that the regimen and psychiatric treatment and psychological treatment is no longer necessary. That, too, is a possibility. But I think the role of all parties would be subject to the Family Parts Wise judgment. The children, I think, would have minimal need to be a part of that process.
Can you clarify something that I thought I heard you say earlier? Did you say that your client still lives with the children and her husband?
Yes, they all live together as an intact family.
But you're not contesting the need, as on the record that currently stands, for continued restraints on her contact?
No.
Unsupervised contact with the children?
Exactly. And we took the position in our petition, and I think as the court's question or as the court's order granting certification indicated, those issues are off the table. While they were contested in the appellate division, we think the more important issue is, frankly, and at this stage, since we're a few years out from the last Family Park proceeding, I would be remiss if I would suggest that we know in any sense what may be necessary, and which is all we're seeking is the opportunity to be able to have the Family Part and counsel address those with the judge that I think Section 12 contemplates having a continuing role if the restraints continue under that statute.
Would it be a compliance hearing or a dispositional hearing on the periodic reviews?
Well, I think the Section 12 contemplates, and as this court's decision in IS contemplated, it contemplates a summary hearing. As the Family Part held for, I guess, 18 months or so.
Right. And I think at the dispositional hearing that the judge held here, the judge took testimony from the treating psychologist and the caseworker.
Yes.
So that would be what you would expect if we remanded for periodic reviews.
Yes, I think that would be what I would expect. And as I suggested, I think the burden on the division would be minimal. And it's frankly something I think that Section 12 contemplates, that kind of not, I hate to use the phrase, but not a quick and dirty kind of approach to a Family Part hearing under Section 12, but certainly an expeditious one.
Like a permanency hearing.
Yes.
Right. And Justice Pierre-Louis asked about the conditions. If we did not reverse, that would be imposed in lifting the restraints. And as I understand it, there were three. Your client must address her mental health issues. She must comply with any recommendations, and she needs to achieve a level of sustained stability. Those things can be addressed at the dispositional hearing if we reversed and remanded anyway, right?
Yes. Yes, so that would be a continuing role for the Family Part judge and for the need, whether those restraints would continue and for how long within that 6 month period. And, you know, it strikes me that to hold a hearing of that, frankly, brevity for at most twice a year is a minimalist burden and certainly is what the legislature contemplated, I would say, under Section 12.
Your adversary says that had the legislature indeed contemplated that any successive extension of a Section 12 order be limited to 6 months, it would have said so expressly, like it did for the Title IX orders, which, as far as I understand, say the court shall define permissible terms and conditions of supervision under this section. The maximum duration of any such term or condition shall not exceed a period of 1 year unless the court finds at the conclusion of that period of 1 year upon a hearing that exceptional circumstances require an extension thereof for an additional year. The language in Section 12 is not nearly as clear, correct?
Well, Your Honor, I can't say correct entirely because I think this court's decision in IS said that any extension essentially would be informed by the reference to the time limit, the 6 month order, that any order entered under that statute, even if it's extended, would only be extended for the period contemplated in the statute. Now, we're dealing here with...
The statute is not explicit about that in the same way that it is for Title IX, correct? I understand the court said that, but I'm saying just reading Title 30 and Title IX, Section 12 of Title 30, Title IX appears to be very explicit in, you know, there it can only be for 1 year, and then there can be a hearing at the end of 1 year, and you can extend it for another 1 year. Whereas here, the statute just says, provided, however, that such order shall not be effective beyond a period of 6 months from the date of entry, unless the court, upon application, extends the time of that order. It doesn't say how long the time the court can extend it for. It, in theory, leaves open that the court could extend at the end of 6 months the order to be indefinite, whereas Title IX is very explicit. It's 1 year and then possibly an additional 1 year, and then you're all done. So how do we interpret, if the legislature was aware of Title IX when it was enacting Title 30, how do we interpret Title 30 to require those type of strict limits?
Well, the legislature was not aware of Title IX. Title IX was enacted in the 1970s. This statute that we're dealing with dates to, in its current form, mm-hmm. to 1962.
Okay.
So we're dealing with and that's frankly why I think this court in IS said that the extensions that were contemplated must abide the initial language of the statute of 6 months in duration. And frankly, it made sense, given what this court also ruled in IS, that this was essentially a no fault. No parental fault was required for entry of an order under Section 12, unlike Title IX, which frankly, I lost that argument before this court in IS when I sought to suggest that there was a fault requirement to be included in 34C12, and this court concluded with wisdom otherwise, but said what you don't need that additional requirement of fault to provide relief in the best interest of children under 34C12 because the relief is time limited and requires periodic review. So I don't think it can be guided necessarily by what happened about 15 years later when the legislature enacted Title IX.
Will you speak to the issue of the burdens that your client would face if asked to file for the relief to remove the restraints on her own going forward?
The burden that she would, I think it would be a substantial burden. Frankly, I think it would be a substantial burden even with counsel, but certainly counsel can draw on experts through the public defender, through the Office of Parental Representation, if there was continuing counsel. The papers would have to be gathered, the documentation required, and the regimen that is specified in the order is frankly, in my mind, as a lawyer, if I was approaching it, intimidating. It's one that requires, okay, have I covered the behavioral? Have I covered the cognitive? Have I covered the medication issues? What is, you know, sustained stability mean? I need an expert to do that.
But that happens regardless. Even if the Title 30 matter is reinstituted, that still has to be proven in order to remove the restraints, correct?
Yes, but counsel and counsel's experts would be alongside the client, guiding her, directing her, preparing the documentation for that, which would be, I would expect, expert reports of various types, affidavits to present to the court, perhaps in lieu of testimony, or testimony of a witness to that effect. Gathering all that information is a substantial undertaking.
And as we stand now, she does not have the assistance of counsel to try to reopen this. She's starting on her own.
That's correct, Your Honor. I'm her last, her last effort in that regard because of the nature of the appeal. But at trial with a closed, permanently closed Title 30 case, she's on her own.
Just to be clear, I mean, she could get private counsel if she was able to or chose to. You're talking about appointed counsel only.
Yes, I'm talking just as she had in this case, a determination of indigency and the receipt of appointed counsel.
Right.
But in any event, whether she has private counsel or appointed counsel, in the situation that we have here, by inference, the burden is now on the parent, not on the division. And your argument is that's not appropriate either.
Exactly. That inverts the contemplated burden that the statute specifies, that at each effort to extend a Title 30, a Section 12 order, the state would have the same burden. It's reversed here. It requires the indigent parent to come forward with showing some kind of as it might occur in a family court custody hearing, so showing changed circumstances. This is not a custody order. This is an order that has specific regimens, requirements, not just the supervision requirement. The family has managed that well on their own. It's these other onerous requirements of the order that are at best vague, but nonetheless still onerous. And to meet that on her own with a burden, as Your Honor suggests, inverts what the statute contemplates.
Other questions, anyone? Anything you'd like to add?
No, Your Honor, just I'll wait for my 3 minutes of rebuttal later on.
We'll have you back. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Ms. Lindhorst.
May it please the court, the ACLU of New Jersey is here today for one very specific reason, to ensure that Jan has access to counsel to assist her in modifying or removing any restraints on her parenting. And to be clear, none of the parties here today question Jan's right to legal representation to remove or modify the restraints. As you heard from Mr. Mitchell, this is a significant concern for the Office of Parental Representation. And the state agencies likewise acknowledge and emphasize the importance of counsel for OLG on pages 15 to 16 of their brief. They emphasize the importance of counsel for both parents and for minors in the event of reopening to modify or remove restraints. And on page 22 of the DCPP brief, footnote 7, the agency indicates that it would not take issue with the appointment of counsel, citing to the statement in DCPP v. SD that in unusual procedures, it is crucial to ensure that the parents are represented by counsel. And this court, of course, has issued a long line of opinions to protect and advance a parent's right to counsel in cases that impact their fundamental liberty interests in parenting, as this does. It is the procedural posture and the murkiness of process in cases like Jan's that could leave her without the support that she needs to address the restraints when she's ready. And we are not here to suggest that DCPP's oversight, surveillance of the family should go on indefinitely, nor are we here to suggest that the court has no authority whatsoever to issue continuing restraints. But in cases like Jan's, if there is no mechanism to ensure representation after terminating the case, as Mr. Mitchell laid out, this effectively closes the courthouse doors to people like Jan. Once Jan's Title 30 case is closed, she no longer has a clear statutory right to appointed counsel. And as Mr. Mitchell made clear, OPR does not interpret that she would continue to have that statutory right to appointed counsel. Now, DCPP and OLG suggest that she would again be eligible to appointed representation once she petitions or applies to modify or remove the restraints on her. But the timing of that is what creates a significant hurdle. That would trigger representation only after filing something. After she would have had to take many affirmative steps, many of which Mr. Mitchell already discussed, including getting the significant mental health treatment that the court has ordered, securing professionals who can provide that treatment and also speak to her health as expert witnesses, and of course, filing the necessary legal documents with this court and under the right docket designation to ensure that she gets the relief she wants and that she gets OPR representation. All of these steps that are on Jan necessitate that she be able to access appointed counsel earlier. Add to that fact that Jan has been diagnosed with serious mental illnesses, which can serve as a major hurdle to getting treatment she needs, getting into the courts, and then succeeding. So we therefore ask this court to find a way to ensure that legal support and legal representation, appointed representation for Jan and others in her position, continues for parents who are subject to continuing restraints after termination of their cases.
Questions, anyone? Anything you'd like to add, counsel?
No.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Wallace?
May it please the court. NJSA 30:4C-12 is a tool that allows the division to seek the court's assistance in those limited instances when there is no abuse and neglect in a family, but services are warranted to ensure the safety of the children. Because Title 30 is about protecting children from harm, the relief ordered under Title 30 can and will vary in each unique familial circumstance. Every family that comes before the court is unique. This case involved a two-parent household, but other cases may involve a one-parent household or two offending parents residing separately or together. All of these variations impact how each case proceeds and how each case is resolved. Under the statute, the family court may find that the best interest of the child requires the court's oversight over the family for 6 months. The court may thereafter, upon notice and opportunity to be heard to all relevant parties, extend the time of the order. After the initial six-month order, no further time limits are prescribed. Nothing in the statute prohibits the court from terminating the litigation with restraints. And that silence is a feature of the statute rather than a defect. Because no two families are alike, this flexibility allows the division and the family court, those with special expertise in this field and a true feel for the case, to fashion remedies for families that cater to their own unique circumstances. Appellant's reading of the statute would tie the hands of the division and the family court in ways that are unsupported by the law's plain language and countless cases that clearly instruct that neither the division nor parents have the right to extend litigation indefinitely until the parents are able to safely care for their children. If a parent is unwilling or unable to correct the circumstances that led to the restriction on contact with the child, termination of the litigation may be appropriate. Appellant's narrow reading of the statute also ignores the impact of protracted litigation on the other parent and the children. An appellant's interpretation of the statute would result in unreasonable outcomes, either leaving children at risk without necessary protections in place, or continuing litigation beyond what is sensible. Cases cannot remain in litigation in perpetuity, and children cannot remain wards of the court indefinitely. Here, after 19 months in litigation, the court afforded JC a plenary hearing with counsel to assist her, then crafted a carefully tailored remedy ensuring the safety of the children while also balancing their best interests and protecting against the impact of protracted litigation. Continued litigation means continued interruptions in a family's daily life in the form of visits by division caseworkers, law guardians and their investigators, and continued court appearances, all of which are mandated by statute or regulation. The trial court evaluated the family's unique circumstances and resolved the case in the best interests of the children. And the restraints imposed by the trial court could be revisited. JC can return to court with counsel to request to lift the restraints in the future if she wishes. The division respectfully asks this court to affirm the appellate division's balanced decision. Nothing in Title 30 expressly precludes ongoing protections when the case is closed. And Title 30, as it is written, contains the flexibility needed to consider each family's unique circumstances. After 19 months, the trial court's remedy imposed the least restrictive restraints possible on JC's parenting rights while still ensuring the children's safety, exactly the kind of tailored remedy envisioned in IS. I'm happy to answer any questions the court may have.
In theory, how long can restraints remain in place after the Title 30 action has been terminated?
It is the division's view that the restraints can remain in place until such time as they are modified or lifted upon a return to the court.
So in the case of a young child, for example, the restraints could remain in place for more than a decade?
Yes.
During that time, is there any court oversight under the construct that you've described?
Once the litigation is terminated, the court's oversight would also necessarily conclude.
And does anyone represent the parent during that period that can extend for some time?
So although there would not necessarily be representation to the parent at that point in time, what is important to look at here is what occurred prior to the termination of the litigation.
Are there any services that are provided during that time?
Once the litigation is concluded?
Yes.
While the division would not be providing services, the parent, in this case, JC, certainly could be at liberty to secure services for herself.
On her own?
On her own. And sometimes parents prefer that.
How does an indigent parent secure services?
Well, there's a couple of avenues that a parent could take advantage of, either locating their own private services or community-based services, or the parent can contact the division. The division has a variety of hotlines and even helplines that it has on its website that it could offer recommendations or direction in terms of community-based services that would be available.
So in this case, the order terminating the litigation said that JC had to comply with treatment recommendations, including CBT therapy, psychiatric treatment with a board-certified adult psychiatrist, and to demonstrate a level of sustained stability. Has the division provided any services since the termination to this individual?
My understanding is that after the litigation concluded, the division also closed its case.
So what language in the statute supports the scheme that you've just outlined for us?
Yes. So in looking at the statute, it is that final clause of the third paragraph where it directs that the court may extend the time of the order. And again, as pointed out earlier, there is no specific designation as to how long that extension might last.
So your argument sounds as though you're saying there's no prohibition in the statute. Where's the authority, though?
Well, the court also has a great amount of authority, as has been set forth in a variety of cases with...
Where's the authority in the statute?
In the statute. In the statute, the court is authorized to make determinations in the best interest of the children based on the record that has been presented. And the court may issue orders as appropriate and therefore extend the time of the order.
Let's assume everything you say is true and correct. What is the mechanism? And I think this is really what your adversary has the problem with. What is the actual mechanism to enable the, in this case, an indigent parent who's represented by the public defender's office, who said, once the case is terminated, we're not representing her. We don't represent her under the case law. What is the mechanism by which she gets back into court, presumably on her own, without advice of counsel, without any structure in place to tell her how to do it?
And so to answer that question, I want to first look at the specifics of this case and then just speak a bit more broadly to that answer. Specifically here, JC did have counsel throughout the litigation.
But she doesn't now.
I understand. She did have, and her counsel was actually crucial in the drafting of the language in that final termination order. Thereafter, we can look to what happens in KLG cases where the final KLG order concludes that litigation. Thereafter, if a parent or a guardian wishes to return to court, they can return to court, they complete an application, and upon that application being submitted to the court, necessarily the Deputy Attorney General returns to the case, the law guardian returns to the case, and bless you, the Office of Parental Representation returns
to the case. Isn't there authority for that process and procedure by rule and statute? KLG is a lot different than this.
It is, but we can look to that process as instructive in terms of what could occur here.
Okay, but we at least acknowledge that that doesn't exist here, and this court would have to craft that for these kinds of cases premised on the theory that an order can be terminated in the case lasts forever unless the parent starts the proceeding in this way that KLG works, presumably with counsel once that starts.
And we do agree that there should be a consistent process similar to KLG or some direction.
Right now there isn't.
Yes, correct. There is currently no consistent process.
So going back to the requirements in the order with regard to the treatment that JC should be seeking during this unending, apparently, period of time during which you should be compliant. So what exactly, from your perspective, are the mental health requirements that she needs to comply with? Are they the requirements that were inputted in the previous orders in this case?
The requirements that the trial court would look to in terms of modifying the restraints if it were to return to court, presumably would be what was set out in that termination order.
But the termination order is pretty general with regard to addressing any mental health concerns, complying with all treatment recommendations. What I'm asking is, what are those treatment recommendations? Are they the recommendations that were previously put in place by previous orders in this case?
The prior orders would be instructive in terms
of. So the prior orders, I think, if I'm looking at one of the prior orders, I think from June, required JC to attend cognitive behavioral therapy with a specific doctor, Dr. Frank MacArthur. Is that what she's required to do now? Because it's my understanding that the division was providing those services.
Right. I mean, so.
And also, she was also supposed to be under the care of a qualified psychiatrist, also under the care of a therapist or social worker. So that's already three different individuals under their care. And I believe during that period of time, when those orders were inputted, the division was providing those services. So now that, as you already noted, now that the case has been terminated, the division is not providing any of those services. So this individual who is indigent needs to find at least three professionals to be under their care, providing care at some degree that would at some point hopefully be satisfactory to a court that's no longer supervising this case. Does that sound like it practically makes sense at all?
So the opportunity here is for the parent to locate their own services. As I mentioned earlier.
You're saying the opportunity, but the burden is on, again, an indigent parent to locate their own services and ensure that the services that they receive from these individuals that they've located is sufficient to comply with the requirements of a court that is not supervising their case.
Well, and again, if the parent wanted to have some communication with the division, even if the division's case is closed, and contacted the division for referrals or direction in terms of services that might meet those parameters or fall within those specified service types, then certainly that individual could contact the division to make those requests for direction. As I said, the division not only has its abuse and neglect hotline, it has a variety of other phone numbers that can be contacted for that assistance.
But just along those lines, practically speaking, what does JC have to do to walk into Bergen County Superior Court and get a hearing before the court to restart the Title 30 action?
Well, and again, although there is no consistent process at this point in time in terms of that mechanism, but that is really what it is, a mechanism that would be needed. We would look to JC perhaps completing some sort of application, submitting that to the court.
There is no application, correct?
Correct. There currently is not that process.
So am I correctly understanding that this is not the only Title 30 case that has been closed with restraints remaining in place?
Yes.
So GCPMP is currently asking the court to close cases with restraints remaining in place with no mechanism existing for those cases to ever be reopened.
Well, arguably, the mechanism that would currently exist is a motion of some sort being filed by the individual asking to modify those restraints.
Examples right now have to be filed by GCPMP, right?
I'm sorry.
I think that ACLU had pointed out in their amicus briefs that all of the forms right now have to be filed by GCPMP. It's always GCPMP that's applying, not the parent that's applying.
So when Title 30 litigation is initiated, yes, it is initiated by the division. However, we see no reason why the pre-existing litigation could not be reopened or reinstituted so that the court could revisit whatever restraints are placed.
If the court concludes that the current mechanism in place is not sufficient to achieve the goals of this of Title 30, based on your experience representing the division, how should the process work if there were to be a reinstatement of the case?
Yes, thank you. So one recommendation that we do have is perhaps a referral to the Family Practice Committee, but as I said, we can look to what happens in KLG cases as instructive. In KLG cases, a parent can return to court, complete an application. It's a fairly brief form that the court has available. And we see this quite often, very, very regularly, in terms of parents and guardians returning to court under KLGs without that initial representation of counsel.
Just for clarification, is this the type of situation where the children are placed in a KLG placement, the parent, for whatever the circumstances might be, feels that it's time to undo that and get full custody to the child back? Is that the scenario?
Yes. Essentially asking for perhaps there were restraints in place for those to be modified or for return of the child to.
So it has some points in common with the situation.
Yes.
So I interrupted you. Please continue with how it would work.
Thank you. So once that application is filed, again, counsel, both for the division as well as the Law Guardian's office, is reinstituted, as well as the Office of Parental Representation. The matter then goes before the court. The court sets down whatever schedule it might set, requests whatever documentation it might request. And that is essentially what we see as being instructive here as a mechanism for these types of cases to be revisited.
What sort of a showing would that application have to make?
So that is the difference with KLG. However, KLGs are clear and convincing. However, here, what we would look to is whatever the burden was at that final termination. So typically preponderance of the evidence would be the standard.
So they'd have to come forward with demonstrative proofs that would justify reopening and do that on their own without counsel?
The initial application although it asks for proofs, they're sometimes not mandated. And oftentimes the court will reopen the matter and then gather additional documentation.
Are you talking about in KLG scenarios?
Yes, comparing
well, what it should
to
it KLG. Be here?
So again, we're looking at perhaps a similar process or similar mechanism being appropriate in these types of cases where an individual could return, make that application, and then the court could look to whatever information might be available. Again, the move-in, the parent, would be the person most well-suited to provide the documentation because presumably they would have letters from their service providers or whatever it might be.
Is an indigent individual who suffers from mental health illnesses the ideal person to make that application?
It's the division's view that that individual certainly could be in a position to make that application, particularly if they have arrived to the point of having the supports of whatever their service providers might be to say that they are in a position to make that showing to the court.
If we agree with you, do we have to reverse IS that's been in place for more than 10 years?
No, the court does not have to reverse IS. And in fact, in looking at IS, really what happened in this case is consistent with IS. In IS, there is some specific language where the court recognizes the flexibility and the authority that is vested with the trial court under Title 30. And in fact, in IS, this court looked at the conclusion of the IS case, although that case differed insofar as there was a separate docket, an FM docket, I believe. But the court here looked at what the trial court did in IS and found that it was a practical resolution based on the record that was before it, and found no issue with the way in which that case was concluded.
Can you clarify something about this case? Did the division ask for continued restraints, or did the judge impose it on the court's own determination?
So when the division was recommending termination of the litigation, it was with restraints in place.
If we don't accept the arguments that you're advancing today and impose periodic reviews, does the child need to be involved in that?
It would be our view that absolutely the children would remain involved. The other parent would obviously remain involved in the litigation. And what is very important to also recall is that when a case is in litigation, as well as involved with the division, there are these very regular checks and contacts with the family that must occur, that are in fact mandated both by statute and by regulation.
Can you explain the way, particular way in which the children would be involved?
Yes. So in terms of court involvement, the children are oftentimes invited to participate in court hearings, sometimes depending on their age. The court may look to interview the children. The court may look to gather information about the children through their representation.
Should the law guardian remain a counsel in the case?
If the matter,
the children?
If the matter is reinstituted, yes. Or if the matter continues, yes, the law guardian's office would be expected to continue as well. And so the children would continue to have their regular meetings with their attorney where they're able to provide whatever feedback they wish to do so. With the division's case being reinstituted, with that comes regular, oftentimes monthly visits from caseworkers, either visiting the children at their home, perhaps at school. There are other things such as service providers or evaluations that could be envisioned that could impact upon the children's daily life. So there is a very real impact on the children.
So I appreciate the way you answered the question that these things may need to be involved. Are there any things that would necessarily involve the children in all of these cases were they to be reopened or not terminated with restraints continuing?
So all of these things are mandated by statute and regulation.
Meaning monthly visits to the home or to the children's school mandated.
Yes, those are directed by regulation. The division is also directed by statute to have regular contact with the children and with the family as a whole. The law guardian's office is mandated and directed by statute as well. The other things such as potentially the children going to court, that obviously is to be determined by the trial court or the other attorneys if they're asking for that.
Do you have any sense of the number of cases in this category?
In terms of cases that conclude in this way?
That have at this point have been concluded, but there are continued restraints.
I do not have a specific number. However, we do see cases conclude, Title 30 cases conclude with restraints. I would not say that it is a rare instance for that to occur, but it is also not something that occurs with too much regularity. But what we also see often is that these types of resolutions are negotiated resolutions. And in fact, even the individual that is restrained is in some way agreeable to the case concluding in that way. And sometimes
you mentioned earlier that counsel in this case for JC drafted the order. Is that?
In reviewing the transcripts for that final hearing, counsel for JC provided to the court some very specific recommendations in terms of language to be placed in the order. Obviously, that language ultimately was up to the trial court, but I believe the phrasing was that counsel had written out or prepared some notes in terms of the order and what should be set forth in the order.
And was that the three requirements that JC would have to meet?
Yes.
And that actually, the language actually originated with her counsel?
Yes.
But you're not suggesting that the counsel consented to
no,
restraint.
No. Counsel okay. was clear that they were
doing what lawyers
not.
Do. Judge, if you're going to put it in, write it this way, not that way.
Yes. Okay. Counsel was clear that they were not in agreement.
Can I just focus really quickly on the last sentence of the statute, Section 12?
Yes.
The order under Section 12 is entered, provided that such order shall not be effective beyond a period of 6 months. Unless upon application of the division, the order is extended. Is it your position that language is confusing?
No, it is our position that language is clear. And what happened here is in accordance with the plain language of the statute. And then looking at the statute coupled with IS, that what happened here was also entirely consistent with what the court has looked at previously in IS, and really focuses on the crucial need for that flexibility to be given to the trial court to craft these types of orders that will meet the need of the family, ensure the best interests of the children, and allow the family to essentially carry on and carry forward.
Is there the possibility for some hybrid solution that goes in between where the division or the court could hold the matter in abeyance or administratively pause the matter so that the division does not have to expend the resources to be involved with the family during that period of time, but the matter is brought back after 6 months so that there's an automatic court appearance required where counsel, the right to counsel is revived and the parent could get ready for that court appearance during those 6 months. Is there some possibility of that?
The statutes and the regulations that direct the division's involvement with a family and those regular appointments that I mentioned earlier are directive and mandatory in terms of their language. So there really is not flexibility in those directives to the division in terms of it carrying out its obligations and having those regular meetings, those monthly meetings with the family.
What regulations or statutes are you relying on specifically?
Yes. So just one moment. So the statute that directs the caseworker visits is NJSA 30:4C-25.
I'm sorry, need that a little slower.
Sorry. It's NJSA 30:4C-25. And then the regulations that direct monthly visitation requirements to the division is NJAC 3A:12-2.6. And I do just want to note that there is another regulation that is directive to the division in terms of case plans. That is NJAC 3A:12-1.4. And I mentioned that because that is also something that the division is obligated to complete with a family on a regular basis. It again involves meeting with a family, having a discussion in terms of what their situation is that is in at that point in time. And so continues that family engagement and that contact with the family and those regular meetings.
Other questions, anyone? Is there anything you'd like to add, Council?
The only thing that I would conclude with is asking this court to affirm the appellate division's balanced decision and also the final order that was crafted by the trial court in this case. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Pollack?
May it please the court. The family court's order is grounded in the overlapping parallel authority of 34C-12 and Parents Patrie. The elimination of the first does not negate the other. The distinct facts of this case highlight the integrated and comprehensive means provided by the legislature to courts when adjudicating challenging family situations. Unlike most cases where custody and parenting time are at issue, the children here live together with their married parents. The family's life is punctuated by JC's severe mental health challenges, characterized by paranoid delusions. Since 2018, the father has accepted help, first from the division and then from the trial judge, but he has not filed a private custody or dissolution complaint. Ultimately, the court found that JC's mental health issues remained unabated while both the father and the oldest child had successfully completed services designed to help them cope with the difficult family situation. At the conclusion of the plenary hearing, the court found the mother's contact must remain supervised to ensure the children's safety. The court entered a corresponding order and provided that the mother could apply to lift the supervision if circumstances changed. The court's order was in the authority of the family court for two reasons. First, the six-month limit on orders authorized by Section 12 does not apply to a court's order terminating care and supervision. A close reading of the statute supports this. Paragraph 2 speaks to the division's authority to apply to the court for an order of care and supervision. Paragraph 3 refers to the court's authority to grant an order as requested. Reading the paragraphs together, the term order in paragraph 3 refers to the order granting the division's request for care and supervision. The order at issue here is not subject to the six-month limitation because it is not an order of care and supervision. Section 12 does not limit the court's authority when the care and supervision action has been adjudicated to conclusion and the litigation terminates. This is in keeping with the purpose of Title 30, to codify the public policy that children's safety is paramount, their best interests are a primary consideration, and preservation and strengthening of the family is a primary concern, but the health and safety of children overrides that. Common sense also dictates this interpretation. Otherwise, the court would have been required to enter an order contrary to its findings. Second, having determined that the division's intervention was no longer in the children's best interests, the judge was left to decide the parameters of custody and visitation. Orders related to custody and visitation are always temporary, subject to a change in circumstances analysis, and governed by the best interest of the child standard. No parent has an absolute right to visitation with a child because that right must comport with and cannot override a child's right to be free from harm. Using these principles, the trial judge exercised her discretion to dismiss the case with the least restrictive limitation on the mother's parental autonomy necessary to protect the children. Without authority to do so, the court's limited options spanned from bad to worse. One choice would be to do as JC requests and continue indefinite court oversight and DCPP involvement in the children's lives with no indication that the mother's functioning would improve. A second choice would be for the court to remove the children from their parents and place them in the division's custody, possibly leading to a guardianship action and thus dismantling the family. Third choice would be for the court to turn a blind eye to the established concerns for the children's safety and terminate the case without restraints. None of these options serve the best interests of the children, as determined by the court. Children have independent rights of their parents, and they cannot wait in perpetuity for their parents to resolve the issues bringing them into the division's purview. There is no cookie-cutter family. The court's order, authorized by law, reflects that. Amici raises thoughtful issues related to the practicality of JC accessing the court to make a future application. In addition to parents, children are entitled to counsel on cases brought under the FN docket. For children, the right emanates from the potential that their interests conflict with those of their parents and the state. It is particularly critical in this case for AC and WC that any future applications be heard under the FN docket, where they are parties and represented, as neither of their parents sought a separate action to solidify the protections provided to them by the family part. Procedurally, JC's application to modify the FN order would only appropriately be brought under the same docket. Once notified of the application, presumably the division would notify the Office of Parental Representation and the Office of Law Guardian, as it does with motions to modify kinship orders and initial filings. Amici also raises the lack of...
Can I stop you there? Do you agree with the Attorney General that if the court were to make some modification in the process here, that the KLG statute, while not the identical considerations, but the process that outlined by the AG, sort of somewhat based on KLG, would be the way to go?
I do agree that would be the way to go. I also think we sometimes see that with applications to vacate an FG order under a judgment under Rule 450. Where there have been changed circumstances, and just hypothetically, the Office of the Law Guardian has had cases where we seek to modify a final FN order.
And I'm sorry, could you explain a little more what that second process is that you think might be analogous? I'm talking about 450 changed circumstances.
Post-termination, after there's been a termination judgment, there are cases where the circumstances change, and there's a motion brought under Rule 450 to vacate the termination judgment due to those changed circumstances. And, you know, similarly, for example, if the resource parent who's to adopt the child dies, and that does happen, practically that judgment cannot be effectuated to adoption, so there will be a motion to change circumstances. That's one of many options.
And what do you see as the role of the children? Obviously, you're talking about you're envisioning your office as a law guardian participating. What do you see as the do you see a necessity in every case for a role for the children, or would that be discretionary?
Under the FN docket, yes, I do. And I'd like to be clear, just as the attorney for the parent is from the Office of the Parental Representation and represents the parent, in the same way, the law guardian is only counsel for the children. The children are parties to the case.
So children are parties. And so you're talking about continued representation of the children by the law guardian. Do you see an additional role for the children themselves other than being represented in the proceeding?
Their position and their interests would have to be presented to the court. That would necessitate their engagement with counsel. But in addition to that, the division, in addition to their regulations, would have to remain involved because at each summary hearing, they would have to have proofs as to why the restriction was still necessary, because it's not just about whether or not the mother has complied with the terms of the order. Circumstances change over time. These children are now 11 and 6. They were 9 and 4 at the time this case was decided. So as those circumstances change, the division would have to continually be gathering information as to the restrictions that were in the best interest of the children.
So if that were the case, wouldn't it be better for the children to have the division involved, providing services?
I do not believe so, because the services had run their course. So having the division involved means, especially over a long period of time, extensive involvement into the children's private lives. So that means documents going to their schools. Each time they switch a new school, each time they have a new pediatrician, that's where the division gathers their collateral. So it's not just the division going to their home, speaking to them, speaking to the other parent. They're very involved in the rest of their life. And the children live under the specter of that, of, you know, the school principal and the main office and their pediatrician knowing that they're involved with DCPP.
But the mental health concerns that the court is concerned about are unabated. So aren't the children still in some jeopardy that may never resolve? And wouldn't it be better to have the court continue to monitor until it perhaps is addressed?
At the point that the case closed, neither court monitoring nor division intervention was bringing about any sort of change. So really, if you're weighing it on a scale, the impact and intrusion into the children's life is much greater than any benefit that comes about from having the court maintain the case as an open case. However, just because the mental health needs were unabated at the time the case was dismissed doesn't mean that when those children are in high school, the impact would be the same of those mental health needs, for better or for worse. That could shift, and it may.
So if the Title 30 closes, does that mean that the law guardian's role ceases? There's no oversight to protect the child or the children? Especially in a situation where the services are required and restraints are necessary?
It does mean, because the Office of the Law Guardian is the attorney to the child when the case is dismissed, that does mean that there's no ongoing engagement with the Office of the Law Guardian. However, there are situations where a formerly represented child will contact the Office of the Law Guardian, and if it's warranted, the Office of the Law Guardian will get back involved. For example, the case I mentioned where the Office of the Law Guardian filed a motion to vacate a custody order, a decision that was dismissed with restraints, because the child was no longer living with the person in the order. And that was accepted by the trial court, and it did proceed. But I do agree that it's not, the procedural mechanism is not clear, and there should be much more clarity to that. That doesn't necessarily impact the provenance of Section 12. It calls out for some guidance as to the administration of the courts.
Questions? Anything else, counsel?
Yes, just briefly. I believe the transcript 11T, which was a plenary hearing, Dr. MacArthur's testimony was that he was retained by the maternal grandparents as opposed to the division. So I do think throughout the case, many of the services were being provided outside of the division. The mother was just signing releases so that the division would have that information.
There's at least one order that indicates that the division was exploring assisting with payment. Do you know what happened with that?
I don't. I was not trial counsel on the case, but I think
there is some indication that there may have been division payment for some of those services, given the orders in this case.
I'm sure they paid for some of them. But I do think it was more mixed than it is in other cases. Because the termination order is authorized by the plain language of the statute, the broader context of Title 30 statutory scheme, and the family part's duty to protect children when parents cannot, the children urge this court to affirm.
Thank you. Mr. Mitchell, rebuttal. As you're walking to the podium, I hope that you can help us with respect to the Attorney General's position that statute and the regulations that she cited require monthly visits. Please comment on that.
I brought my statute book just for that purpose, Your Honor. This statute that was cited by the Attorney General, the 34C-25, doesn't provide monthly. It just uses a very general term, regularly visit. As I think Justice Noriega pointed out, the suggestion makes perfect practical sense to me, that you hold a case in abeyance rather than dismiss it. That way, the opportunity for services continue. Regular visits in a case such as this might mean once every 6 months rather than once a month. Certainly, the
regulation says once a month, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. And the regulation would be subject to, I would think, this court's direction on the flexibility that the division has in cases such as a 34C12 case, as 4C25 contemplates. Regular, when there's intense need and children are in peril, might mean once a week. It might mean once a month. If there's no reason, it cannot mean something with a longer term that would comport with what the legislature said in 1962 in Section 12, periodic review every 6 months. So I think that should not be an impediment to this court's construing Section 12 in a manner that suggests that the division might have flexibility where a case such as this may warrant less intrusive, less frequent involvement by the division.
How do you respond to the division's position that if we accept the division's position as supported by the law guardian, that we would not need to reverse IS?
I think that's entirely inconsistent, Justice. The this court used the word temporary, I believe, at least five times in IS in the section in which it provided an explication of Section 12.
I'm sorry, give us a little more context to that. What does that temporary in modifying what?
That the order entered under Section 12 would be temporary. This court used that in several different contexts, but in every context in which this court used the word temporary, I believe it's five instances on a single page of the published opinion. At least that as it appears on Westlaw.
What does temporary mean? If you have, obviously, when the children reach adulthood, at the very latest, all of this is over.
That's correct.
So when you say that, when you refer to IS saying that the order would be temporary, why is that inconsistent with providing additional hearings and having the court intervene at certain increments, but keeping the case essentially in abeyance?
Justice Patterson, I don't think I disagree with anything that you said. I think that correctly recounts IS, except that the word temporary, I believe that this court was referring back to the 6 month period of the limitation, the time limitation on a court's order as the reason it was justifying the flexibility that Section 12 provided to the family part to address without finding any parental fault of any kind. No one was responsible for any harm to a child, just the family part and the division needed to be involved. Section 12 provided that authority, and that authority was cabined by the time limit that the legislature provided in 1962. To 6 months. And the notion that we don't have a mechanism, you might say, to continue this case, I think is a red herring. I think we do have a mechanism. The mechanism is in Section 12. The mechanism is periodic review. And periodic review is not an onerous burden, frankly, I would suggest, on the division nor on the family part. That the nature, as I think one could construe what Justice Noriega suggested, I believe Justice used the word hybrid or held in abeyance. That I think that's a very helpful guide, and it's consistent with Section 12, and it's consistent with the guidance of the legislature in Section 12 to maximize the flexibility that the division would have in a case such as this. And in that regard, I think it's the there was an exchange with the Deputy Attorney General in which she used the word there are countless cases. And then I think in a further exchange with Justice Patterson, she conceded that these were infrequent at best. And I think that's the certainly in all the unpublished cases that were provided to this court by the Attorney General, the three or four of them that there were in the JD case that the Law Guardian cited in its supplemental brief, they all involved orders entered under different statutes. Non-section case started out as a Section 12 case, but the orders were entered either in a custody case that developed from it, an FD case or an FM case. And I think that is why this case is so infrequent, but why it's so important. Because, as I think the Chief Justice said, can this go on for a decade? And there was no limitation to that time frame. I think it would be entirely inconsistent with what the Section 12 contemplates and what the legislature contemplated. And although the restriction to a Title IX case to a year and then a year extension was added a decade or so later, that doesn't alter what the legislature said, where we would provide this kind of flexible authority to a family court judge to intervene in the life of a family, as they did here, not just to require supervision, but to require compliance with a regimen of psychological, psychiatric, and medication, and to be able to come back to court to do that, is something that I think contemplated an ongoing case that would have a judge assigned to it, have a judge supervising it, and whether it's the children or whether it's the parents are not left to their own devices to figure out how do I address the concerns here. And that's not to say that a parent in this situation hasn't had any supervision other than with the family members. Why that would require the division to somehow intervene more severely than they have for the last 2 years, when the parents and children and have managed their affairs well, perhaps we revisit this and we bring back the experts as the Section 12 contemplates, and we learn that the mental health concerns have abated or not.
And that can be done in a summary fashion, as Section 12 points out. I used to do these when I was a CIC judge in Union County. It can even be done on the papers. It's not a very lengthy process.
Correct. I think that's exactly what we are seeking here. Not a lengthy process, not detailed intervention by the division in the lives of the parents or the children, but an assessment of how are things going? Does it make sense for us to continue this? And to have what is really the gift that New Jersey gives to families in this situation, that is the supervision of a family court judge. And that cannot be underestimated, I think. And I think that's what, respectfully, the respondents minimize, that the involvement of a family court judge is vital for everyone concerned.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Did I catch you before you?
I just have one item to close with.
Thank you. One more quick one.
Thank you, Chief Justice. I appreciate it. This court's judgment should uphold the promises made 60 years ago by the legislature to New Jersey families who face the power and demands that's reflected in a Section 12 order. Such power and demands cannot be left effectively unreviewable, as occurred in this matter, and a parent in the process robbed of a right to counsel and all that entails. When the power and demands of the state are continuing, the Section 12 case respectfully also must, with its time limits, its periodic review, and its assurance of counsel's assistance. Thank you very much, Your Honors, for your time and your patience.
Thank you. Thank you to all counsel for the helpful argument. We'll take the matter under advisement.